on this 20th day of July, 2011, in Winnipeg, Canada. We are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Third canto, chapter 25, The Glories of Devotional Service, by Kapila Dev's teachings to his mother. Text number 21. Titikshavakarunika.
Titikshavakarunika.
Sudidaksaradehinam.
Sudidaksaradehinam.
Ajatashatavakshantha.
Ajatashatavakshantha.
Sadavaksadubhushanaha.
Sadavaksadubhushanaha.
Translation. The symptoms of a sadhu are that he is tolerant, merciful, and friendly to all living entities. He has no enemies. He is peaceful, he abides by the scriptures, and all his characteristics are sublime. Purport. A sadhu, as described above, is a devotee of the Lord. His concern, therefore, is to enlighten people in devotional service to the Lord. That is his mercy. He knows that without devotional service to the Lord, human life is spoiled. A devotee travels all over the country from door to door preaching, "Be Krishna conscious. Be a devotee of Lord Krishna. Don't spoil your life simply fulfilling your animal propensities. Human life is meant for self-realization or Krishna consciousness." Close quote. These are the preachings of a sadhu. He is not satisfied with his own liberation. He always thinks about others. He is the most compassionate personality towards all the fallen souls. One of his qualifications, therefore, is karunika, great mercy to the fallen souls. While engaged in preaching work, he has to meet with so many opposing elements, and therefore the sadhu, or devotee of the Lord, has to be very tolerant. Someone may ill-treat him because the conditioned souls are not prepared to receive the transcendental knowledge of devotional service. They do not like it. That is their disease. The sadhu has the thankless task of impressing upon them the importance of devotional service. Sometimes devotees are personally attacked with violence. Lord Jesus Christ was crucified. Haridas Thakur was caned in 22 marketplaces. And Lord Chaitanya's principal assistant, Nityananda, was violently attacked by Jagai and Madhai. But still, they were tolerant because their mission was to deliver the fallen souls. One of the qualifications of a sadhu is that he is very tolerant and is merciful to all fallen souls. He is merciful because he is the well-wisher of all living entities. He is not only a well-wisher of human society, but a well-wisher of animal society as well. It is said here, sarva-dehinam, which indicates all living entities who have accepted material bodies. Not only does the human being have a material body, but other living entities, such as cats and dogs, also have material bodies. The devotee of the Lord is merciful to everyone, the cats, dogs, trees, etc. He treats all living entities in such a way that they can ultimately get salvation from the material entanglement. Shivananda Sen, one of the disciples of Lord Chaitanya, gave liberation to a dog by treating the dog transcendentally. There are many instances where a dog got salvation by association with the sadhu, because the sadhu engages in the highest philanthropic activities for the benediction of all living entities. Yet, although a sadhu is not inimical toward anyone, the world is so ungrateful that even a sadhu has many enemies. What is the difference between an enemy and a friend? It is a difference in behavior. A sadhu behaves with all conditioned souls for their ultimate relief from material entanglement. Therefore, no one can be more friendly than a sadhu in relieving a conditioned soul. A sadhu is calm and he quietly and peacefully follows the principles of Scripture. A sadhu means one who follows the principles of Scripture and at the same time is a devotee of the Lord. One who actually follows the principles of Scripture must be a devotee of God, because all the Shastras instruct us to obey the orders of the personality of Godhead. Sadhu, therefore, means a follower of the scriptural injunctions and a devotee of the Lord. All these characteristics are prominent in a devotee. A devotee develops all the good qualities of the demigods, whereas a non-devotee, even though academically qualified, has no actual good qualifications or good characteristics according to the standard of transcendental realization. Right, so that's the end of the purport, but I'm going to read the next verse, so we will cover all eight verses. Okay. And they go together also. So further describing the sadhu, Lord Kapila says, "My anamnena bhavena bhaktim kurvanti ye dvidham. Matkate chakta karmanas chakta swajana bandhavaha." Such a sadhu engages in staunch devotional service to the Lord without deviation. For the sake of the Lord, he renounces all other connections, such as family relationships and friendly acquaintances within the world. Purport. A person in the renounced order of life, a sannyasi, is also called a sadhu because he renounces everything, his home, his comfort, his friends, his relatives, and his duties to friends and to family. He renounces everything for the sake of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A sannyasi is generally in the renounced order of life, but his renunciation will be successful only when his energy is employed in the service of the Lord with great austerity. It is said here, therefore, bhaktim kurvanti ye vidham. A person who seriously engages in the service of the Lord and is in the renounced order of life is a sadhu. A sadhu is one who has given up all responsibility to society, family, and worldly humanitarianism simply for the service of the Lord. As soon as he takes his birth in the world, a person has so many responsibilities and obligations to the public, to the demigods, to the great sages, to the general living beings, to his parents, to the family forefathers, and to many others. When he gives up all such obligations for the sake of the service of the Lord, he is not punished for such renunciation of obligation. But if for sense gratification a person renounces all such obligations, he is punished by the law of nature. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakya Chakshu Unmidatam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So, recapping from the beginning of this Sadhu Sangashtika, you may remember, Prasangam Madaram Pasham Atmana Kavayo Vadu Seheva Sara Shukato Moksha Dvarama Pavataha. That the tight ropes of attachment that we experience in our material life, and everybody has them, even in a human life as well as previous or lower species, in the human form, we have the opportunity to transfer that affection or attraction and attachment to sadhus or great souls. And by doing that, we open the doors to liberation. Otherwise, we remain tightly bound up by these ropes and we suffer birth and death perpetually. So this is the way out. So then the next question is, who's the sadhu? And so in two verses, he's describing the nature of that sadhu. So yesterday, the first qualification is titikshava, is tolerant. So tolerance has two sides. We normally think of tolerance as tolerating some pain, especially this word titikshava means that. There's other words that mean tolerance that are not that don't emphasize the physical pinching, like the titikshava means, you know, real cold or real hot, real dry, or the others causing you so much suffering. There's so many difficulties in this world. One has to tolerate them without being disturbed, without the mind being disturbed. So, and then even more important qualification, karunika, is that he's merciful. As Prabhupada points out in the purport, that being merciful means to give others a chance to become sadhus as well. In other words, giving them Krishna consciousness. And in so doing, one is bound to meet with opposition. He gives some very famous examples of Jesus Christ, who was crucified, Haridas Thakur, who was caned in 22 marketplaces, and because he converted from Islam to Vaishnavism, and Nityananda Prabhu, who was attacked by Jagannath Madai. So in every one of those cases, each of them continued to be merciful and give out the instruction. And because they were instructing, and because they were trying to give others Krishna consciousness, that they were attacked. The same is holds true for Prahlad. Prahlad was a thorn in his father's side because he wasn't learning the Machiavellian teachings of the teachers, Shandana Marka, who were trying to train him up to be a good demon. But Prahlad was having none of it. So that was an annoyance for his father. But when he started teaching his classmates, that was it. Now he's subverting the whole kingdom. You know, now the whole foundations are. So his father tried to kill him, and we know the result. One has to be merciful. One has to be tolerant in order to really be merciful. And that mercy is expressed sudadak sarvadehinam, because one really feels the friendship of all, or friendship toward all living entities. Now we know from the Bhagavad Gita, the famous peace formula at the end of the chapter 5, that Krishna says, bhoktaram yagita basam sarvaloka maheshwaram sudidam sarvabhutanam gyapamam shantamichati. That one who really wants peace in this world, both individually and for everyone else, has to recognize, says Krishna, that I am the enjoyer of all sacrifices, I am the lord of all worlds, and I am the friend of all. Sudidam sarvabhutanam. This is said many places in the Shastra. So how is it that here it says sudiduk sarvadehina? Same thing. The sadhu is the friend. Well, the sadhu is the friend of all because he introduces them to their eternal real friend of Krishna. What greater friend could there be who tries to bring you in touch with your eternal friend who can really give you all protection and all benefit? So both are the friends. And the sadhu is the one who recognizes Krishna as the ultimate friend, and he tries to introduce everyone to their real friend. And therefore, for that reason, he has no enemy. He regards everyone as a friend. He feels that sense of kinship, knowing that Krishna is the Supreme Father. There's no distinction between races and languages and nationalities and all this business. And because he has no material desire, he doesn't envy anyone for what they have, or try to get what they have and feel enmity toward them because they're trying to get what he has. If they want to have what he has, he's ready to give it. Because what he has is only Krishna consciousness. You want what I have? Take it. So these are, and he's very peaceful, therefore he's very peaceful. Because without material desire, you can actually be peaceful. So these are the ornaments of a sadhu. And he goes on. Of course, the whole thing is resting on the fact that mayananin bhavina, bhaktin kurvani, that such a sadhu is a pure devotee. Ananyena, this word ananyena means without deviation. The mind is fixed on devotional service. Unflinching, unalloyed. Bhaktim kurvanti yedridham, and because with great determination. Again, that it probably talks about the sannyasi here, who has to be very determined to overcome all sorts of internal and external difficulties. So bhakti has to be with a firm determination. This word comes up in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna talks about how one can get beyond the dualities of happiness and distress, heat and cold. Yesham dvandakatam papam jananam punyakarmanam te dvandamohane mukta vanyate mam dridhavrata. The word dridhavrata is the same as the word dridham here. A strong vow. The formula there is one who is sinless, who is not performing any sinful activity, and is doing simply pious activity. In this case, pious activity means bhaktun mukhi sukriti, which means that kind of pious activity which arouses bhakti. Just like Krishna's friends, Prabhupada says, they had amassed heaps of punya, krita punya punja. Punja means a big pile, in order to be able to play with it, in Vrindavan. That word is in the 10th canon. And that's Prabhupada's translation in the Krishna book. So that's how one can be firm in his devotional service. Free of all sin, only doing pious activities, and thus free of the delusion of duality. The delusion or the illusion of duality. That things in this world are good and bad. This is really good. Oh, I'll try for that. Bad, or avoid that, or combat it. Hot and cold. This is the dualities of this world, but ultimately it's just the material energy moving. It's all Krishna's energy. So that's a very strong illusion that we have because of these senses, because of our conditioning. We're always making these distinctions, This person is my enemy, this person is my friend. So one can transcend that illusion of duality and serve Krishna with firm determination. So that's the nature of the sadhu. And then matkute chakta karma nath chakta swajana bandhava, that he's ready to renounce all activities that are impediments to devotional service, all material activities. If an activity can't be dovetailed, of course we have to maintain, so there has to be a way of maintaining ourselves and putting a roof over the head and eating and all these things. Well, there's a way of doing that spiritually. within Varnashram, like that, under the instructions of the Shastra and the Guru. And even Chakta Swajana Bandhava. Now this, of course, is mentioning a sannyasi who renounces these familial ties and goes. But it's not, but was Bhaktivinoda Thakur a sadhu? Of course he was. He was the greatest sadhu. So the idea is that when those material ties are impediments, then one has to be, you know, in other words, they can't be brought into the field of devotional service. Then one has to be ready to renounce everything for the sake of Krishna consciousness. That's the real sadhu. But it's certainly true that, as Prabhupada pointed out, most of Lord Chaitanya's associates were householders. So they were highest sadhus. So there's if one can have these other qualities, you know, tatikshava, kadar, merciful and tolerant, you know, who is more tolerant than Bhaktivinoda Thakur? Now, in this regard, it's interesting. I just thought of this. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the great acharya, was father of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He was undoubtedly a sadhu. He had all of these qualities. And there's this story of Bishikishen. You know the story of Bishikishen? Okay. This is a wonderful story. It's told in great detail in this book called The Seventh Goswami, which is on your iPad. It's one of the books. And it's also in the database. So anyway, what happened was that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his life as a minister, a judge, and also in charge of the Jagannath Puri temple, you know, there was a very great position of responsibility that the British put him into. So at that time, and maybe now also, you know, now at that time in say the late 19th century, height of the British Raj, there was a fellow who had claimed to be Mahavishnu. This was not uncommon. He was living out in the country near in Orissa somewhere, and he had developed some mystic powers. He was a yogi, you know. He had some mystic powers, and he was curing so many people. And he was showing these siddhis or powers, and he had a huge following. And he was claiming that he was going to overthrow the Raj, that the king would be killed, or the queen, maybe Victoria, whoever it was, and that all the British would be killed, and you know, all this stuff. So he was seditious as well as, you know, claiming to be God. So this was a big disturbance, and they assigned Bhaktivinoda Thakur the task of arresting him for, you know, for sedition. So the story goes that he went. Now he had also appointed a fake Shiva and Brahma. So you have Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu. Now he was also, you know, engaging in a rasa dance. He was seducing the wives of some prominent Brahmins and everything. It became to be a very great disturbance in the community there. But he still had a big following. You know, people, they were taken in, simple people. You know, so. Wasn't easy. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur first went there with a small contingent, a squadron of, you know, soldiers, British soldiers. And he goes, you know, to the spot. It's in the forest, and there's a huge crowd around, and he's sitting in front of this fire, you know, this Mahavishnu. You know. And he's very arrogant. Hey, Babu, I knew you were coming. You know, and he tells him his name. You know, he has some... What's up? You know, forgive me. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, "Well, you're getting all this worship. Why don't you come to Puri and worship Jagannath?" And he says, "Oh, he's just a wooden god. You know, I'm the real god. You've heard this term. And I'm going to take over the country." You know, so these were great offense, obviously. So Bhaktivinoda wouldn't, you know, agree to that. He chastised him, but he didn't do anything at that time because he only had a small squadron. You know. So he says, "If you don't give up this nonsense, we're going to arrest you and punish you." You know, so see what you can do. And so he showed some of his mystic powers. He leaned into the fire and came out of it without being burned. You know, and he shook his head, and all kinds of flames came out from his hair. And the soldiers were scared. You know, they better step back. You know, first of all, they're outnumbered. Now here's this guy with mystic powers. And then somebody came up who was lame, who had some serious disease, and he cured him at once, you know, like that. So you can imagine how the people were convinced, you know, they worshipped him. So Bhaktivedanta wasn't impressed, and he said, "We're not impressed with your tricks, you know. We're going to come back and get you." So he left, and then a few days later, maybe the next day, he comes back with, like, you know, 100 soldiers, you know. And Mahavishnu, Vishikashen, is shocked. You know, "What do you think you can do? You know, I'm Mahavishnu." And Bhaktivinoda said, "I don't care what you do. You know, we're going to get you. We're going to arrest you now. Come with us." So he really couldn't do anything. And so he was put into a cart, and all the people were following, and the soldiers were defending, and they arrested him and take him to town, to Orissa, to Puri. So then there's a trial. There's a trial that ensues. And it goes on and on for, I don't know, weeks. And he's not eating anything, he's not drinking anything, he's not sleeping. But he's staying robust, you know. And he's got all his followers demonstrating outside the jail, you know. So Bhaktivinoda, after a few days, you know, he says, "Okay, tomorrow we're going to have the judgment." So Bhishikashen is, you know, furious, you know, his blazing eyes. He says, "Just go home and look at the catastrophe that's occurred." You know, so Bhaktivinoda goes home. And when his youngest daughter is comatose, like they can't wake her up, something like that. You know, she's very sick, and his mother pleads, "Oh, please let him go, you know, see what's happening, he's going to kill all of us." You know, and Bhaktivinoda says, "No, you know, let him kill all of us, I'm going to show my judgment," you know. So there's a lot of anxiety in home, you can imagine. And Bhaktivinoda, so the next morning is the morning of the judgment. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself feels a sharp pain in his side. He can't walk, you know. So he has to be carried in a stretcher, a palanquin, you know, to give the judgment. He's not warded off, I guess. So he goes, and he issues a judgment. You're guilty of sedition and blasphemy, whatever. 6 months in jail. Yeah, so it's a huge uproar, you know, the soldiers are holding off the swarms of people, mobs. And so then as Vishikashin is coming off the dock and, you know, getting into the jail, I guess he's in shackles at that time. One of the British guys, officials who had read something, you know, they all learn something about yoga and this and that sometimes. He read that the yogis keep their strength in their hair, and he had these big locks down, you know, dreadlocks thing. So he got behind him with these big shears and he cut off his hair. And as soon as he cut off his hair, because he's saying he's crumpled to the ground, how did he carry it? Because he was, you know, he hadn't been eating or drinking. So, you know, he stayed, and actually after a few months he committed suicide. But the point of the story is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was ready to sacrifice everything for the truth. So he really showed himself to be a sadhu. But, you know, by the same token, he, you know, fathered Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he trained him as a Vaishnava. So he was a true sadhu. And he didn't chuck this Swajana Bandhava. He didn't literally leave. Eventually, near the end, he took Babaji and secluded himself. That was another thing. But these are the critical qualities of the sadhu. He's tolerant, merciful to all, friend to all, hasn't have any enemy, is a pure devotee of Krishna, and give up any activity not conducive to Krishna consciousness, and not be bound by family affection if that is an impediment to devotional service. So on this business of chakta karmanas, now this brings up a point of a surrender, because so much of Krishna consciousness has to do with what we call sharanagati, taking shelter. We always take shelter, you know, even in a material life. We need shelter. We got this house, but we also have the body itself is a shelter for the soul. And we have our job, we have all these different things that we hang on to because they provide us means of subsistence and living in this world. So, and oftentimes we'll take shelter of false philosophies. This is the problem, is that we don't know the truth, that we're full of ignorance. And but the soul, is there is always a spiritual impetus there. We're always reaching for the eternal and for ultimate happiness. That's why we're never satisfied in material life, because the soul by nature is Satchitananda, full of bliss, full of knowledge, eternal. But in our conditioned life, we're anything but. So that's it. There is that sense, even though we can't articulate it, of dissatisfaction with this material life. And therefore, the spiritual impetus is universal. It's proved by history. I remember, I used to be involved, and I've probably mentioned this before, as a communist when I was a kid. That was my religion. So we idolized Russia, and later on China, And part of the Russian business, part of the communist control, was to try to stamp out religion. Well, they found they couldn't stamp out religion. The Russian Orthodox Church was powerful. They had a lot of people who had a lot of faith in them, and they found that, they can't stamp it out, so we'll control it. And people can worship in this way, that way. The churches, they restricted that. They made churches into museums or factories, but you can have a church of it. So they restricted. They hoped that eventually it would die out with the older, because old timers, they're not going to give up their religion, they're used to it. But all the kids learned atheism, like that. So it went on for 70 years, from more than 70 years. From 1917 was a revolution in Russia, and the whole thing broke down about 1990. So that's about, 72, 73 years. So you have plenty of time to raise several generations of total atheists, in the schools. So, but what happened? As soon as it broke in 1990 and they had some freedom of religion, people just came out of the wood. You had Hare Krishnas going in there, the Christians, everybody, the Mormons, and everybody was completely fascinated. They felt they needed something spiritual. Just the material was so dry, especially when you have so much austerity in Russia, they couldn't. So they couldn't stamp it out. Same thing in China. So that's there. But unfortunately, this is the age of so many bogus yogis and misguiders and false religions. So that natural impetus is often betrayed by false instructors. And that's why Srila Prabhupada's great mission, his central mission that he felt most important about, was giving the science as it is through his books, through his teachings, and also manifesting it through ISKCON and through us, to show the reality and the supremacy, frankly, of bhakti yoga, Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Krishna is God. There's no compromise. But because there's a war on, not a physical war, but there's a war on for the hearts and minds of everyone who in the world who has some kind of spiritual spark. Some people, they've really given it up. They're out and out atheists. There's no question. But for the vast mass of people, they're innocent, and they can be brought into, they can become interested in the real thing, and they can become devotees. So therefore, he was so keen to have the international side of the Krishna consciousness to give people. This was Lord Chaitanya's movement, and that's the real, key quality of the sadhu. Prabhupada talks about in the first purport how he's not just satisfied with his own advancement. The real devotee feels that kinship, with everyone. And therefore that mood, so nicely described by Purananda Saraswati in his it's not in the Chaitanya Chandramrita. I'm sorry, it's another work. I think Raghunath Das Goswami describes that padaduka duki, in that verse, I think he's describing Sanatana Goswami. But padaduka duki literally means that you feel others' pain as your own. That's perfect empathy. Sympathy. And if you feel others' pain is your own, you want to relieve it. You want to try. That's the idea. This is the whole basis of really civilized life. If everyone is simply out to grab as much for himself, and just step on the heads of everyone else, you have animal life, you have the jungle. But human life is meant to cooperate for the benefit of all. So Prabhupada mentions here that's the real quality. The impersonalists don't have that. The impersonalists are looking for their own liberation, and therefore they go off to the forest or the hills generally, or the mats, and just stay there, you know, and meditate and do their thing, you know, to get away from any distractions. So this is the central verse that I, you know, Prahlad's prayers in his prayers to Lord Nrisimhadev. Near the end of those prayers, he has two that I regard as like, you know, flags or like mottos, you know, that Prabhupada took in his heart, and really, not just Prabhupada, but all of our preachers, Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda, those who really strove more than anything else to spread this knowledge as well as to relish it. They took this, you know, as the moving force. And so Prahlad says to Lord Nrisimhadev, he says, Naiva vijay padadurakte yavaitaranyas padviriya gayana mahamata mandachitta shocheta to vimukacheta se indiyata maya sukhaya badamudbhito vimudhant. So in the first part of this verse, Prahlad says, I don't have any problem, personally. Naivod Vijay. He proved that he had no problem, even when his father was trying to kill him. He didn't regard that as a problem. You can imagine how advanced he was. He was simply praying, it was transcendental to the whole thing. So, Naiva Udvijay. I am not disturbed by anything. Because I know, I've already gone beyond the river Vaitarami. There's like this river, said to be a river between the material and spiritual world. So I'm already on the other side, even though physically it seems like I have, you know, on this side. But it's where your consciousness is at whether you're liberated or not. I'm already liberated, and I know that anywhere, or any time, Tvadvirya Gayana, I can chant your powerful glories and Mahamata Magna Chitta, and in this way immerse myself in the greatest nectarian bliss just by remembering you. Regardless of my external situation. So then how can there be any problem for me? But, shocetato, I am lamenting, not about myself, but for these vimudhas, these foolish souls who, what is their foolishness? Vimukacetasa, they've turned their face away from you, their consciousness, their face, away from you, Lord, for the sake of indriyata, for the sake of the pleasures of the senses. Maya sukhaya, and they're trying to enjoy this flickering, illusory happiness known as sense gratification. And this is a great burden to try to enjoy. Then you have to bear this burden of the body and make so much money and beat off others who are trying to get what you have. And it's called bottom. They're bearing this burden, and therefore they're foolish. So what can I do about it? And then in the next verse, he continues, Prayena deva muneo Suvamukti kama maunam chanandi vijanena purata nishta. So in this first two lines, he describes what most of the other transcendentalists do. Prayena, for the most part, O Lord, deva muniyo, the learned, those who are learned, at least understand that they're not the body, they may know Brahman versus spirit. Suvamukti kama. Now this is an interesting phrase, because kama means lust. But here he's saying this is lust for mukti. It's a strong desire for their own liberation. Just as if someone is beating you on the head, you have a strong desire that they stop. So the material energy is beating us all around the head. You know, birth, death, old age, disease, threefold miseries, too hot, too cold, you know, earthquakes, whatever, you know, disease. These are called threefold miseries, culminating in birth, old age, disease, and death. So stop. This is a very strong desire. But it's a personal desire. It has nothing to do with Krishna. It has nothing to do with anyone else. It's so that you can be relieved of misery. So this is called swa-vimukti kama. Strong desire for one's own liberation. And to that end, maunam charanti. They remain silent. They don't speak the knowledge. And they go where? Vijane. Maunam charanti vijane. Where there's no people. Vijane means in the solitary caves of the Himalayas or the jungles, or something like that. Naparata nishta, having no determination to help anyone else. This is the impersonalist. But Prahlad says, I'm not going to do that. Naitam vihaya kripana vimamuksha eko. I'm not going to give up these kripanas, these wretched souls. In other words, I'll abandon them to their fate if I don't try to teach them. Naitan Vihaya Kripana Vimamoksha Eko, simply wanting my own liberation, solely, Vimamoksha Eko. Because Nanyam Tvadasti Sharanam Brahmato Anupashi. I cannot see any other shelter but you, O Lord, or any other hope for shelter but you, O Lord, for those who are wandering in this material world. So this is kind of the anthem. You know, see, the Prabhupada took these two verses, and you can see they put him on that boat, they brought him to New York, he struggled, you know, in the latter part of his life, deteriorating health, you know, because he wanted to help the Vimudas, us, you know, me anyway, who had turned away from Krishna. So this is the real mark of a sadhu. Such a soft heart, such an expansive heart, that give up their own life, basically. Risk their own life for the benefit of others. And with that kind of attitude, of course, you win the greatest benedictions from Krishna, you can imagine. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, natta tasma manusheshu kastime priyakuttama, that for those who are teaching the science to others, there will never be a greater servant than mine, and never one more dear to me. This whole process, we should remember every so often, is simply so that we can become dear to Krishna. Now, of course, everyone is dear to Krishna, but he says in the Gita, especially those who are serving me, who are my devotees, I reciprocate, they are in me, I am in them. So we can feel Krishna's love for us. That's the whole purpose of this exercise of bhakti. So there's a few words on who is a sadhu and their internal and external symptoms. And if there's any discussion, we can entertain that at this time. You understand who's a sadhu? Do you want to become a sadhu, Rishi? Good idea? Yeah, I think so. And Raga, you can be a sadhvi. Okay? A female sadhu. You're already a female sadhu. Hare Krishna. Any other discussion? Okay, so tomorrow we'll proceed with some more nectar about sadhus. Sadhu Sangha. Sadhu Sangha, yeah.
Prayers. Uh-huh. So that is a karma.
Swabhimukti karma.
So that is also a, is also considered as a part of karma?
Yeah. In a broader sense, karma just means material desire. Mm-hmm. And what does material desire mean? Desire for something for me, apart from Krishna, apart from anyone else. You know, so karma, you know, also means, of course, sense desire, sex desire. But all these things, you know, all material desires come into their karma. Lord Chaitanya has a famous verse, who is really peaceful? Because that's one of the qualities of the sadhu, peaceful, right? Shanta. So he says, Krishna bhakta nishkama ateva shanta bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakali ashanta. So the devotees, Krishna bhakta, nishkama, because he doesn't want anything for himself, only for Krishna and for those who he can try to help bring to Krishna, for the devotees, everything. The real devotees, you'll always see the service. They're always trying to help, you know. The other devotees, or the temple, or whatever, you know, that's the. So, nishkama, therefore they're peaceful. Ateva shanta. But bhukti mukti siddhi kami. A kami is a person who is filled with kama. You know? There's three kinds. Bhukti kamis, 99.999%, simply wanting gross and subtle sense gratification. But there's also mukti kamis, as Prahlad says, as Lord Chaitanya says, those who are just desirous of their own mukti. The heck with everyone else. Or siddhis. The yogis who want to get, you know, these powerful cities, Vishwamitra and others, you know. Oh, I can fly through the air, you know. I can make some dust, you know. Foolish. You know, the greatest siddhi is prema. Nitya siddha Krishna prema. Sadhya gavanoi. The eternal perfection is Krishna prema. So forget all these other cities. You know, the scientists have imitated those. You want to fly through the air? They fly through the air. You want to go through the ground? They go into the ground. You want to become light? They give you a parachute. You know? You know everything? Oh, you got the computers, the NSA, we know everything. You know? They tried to do it. But it's foolish. Waste of time. So that's a different kind. And therefore, Bhukti Mukti Siddhika, Sakali, Ashanta. All of these are not peaceful. Because you never have enough cities. I've got 6 of the 8 cities, but that someone else has 8 cities? I'm envious. Like, you know, like, who is it? Durvasa. Durvasa Muni. You know, Durvasa means really that his clothes are far away. In other words, he's naked. Although they don't paint him that way. But the yogis do that, you know, walk around naked. So, but he's envious. You know, he's a powerful yogi, but he's envious of Ambarish because he's getting too much honor. So I don't tell the whole story, but you know, he proved weaker than Ambarish. Ambarish was a greater yogi. Talk about tolerance, Tatikshava. This Durvasa, Muni, you know, he's one of the Munis who is Siddhi Kami. He created a demoness, a fiery demoness, because he felt offended by Ambarish, to try to kill Ambarish. You know, a big demoness whose body is full of fire. Suppose it's coming at you right now. All of us would run out the door. But Ambarish, he just sat there. He just stood there. Oh, this is Krishna's will, let it come. Now that's tolerance. And of course, the chakra, Narayan protected him with his chakra, killed the demoness, and went after Durvasa. Durvasa didn't have that kind of tolerance. He ran. He didn't want to get burned up by the chakra. So you can see the difference. So yes, mukti can also be fall within the realm of karma. Yes, Guru?
You mentioned gross and subtle sense gratification. What would the distinction be between those?
Oh, well, gross sense gratification, sex life, you know. Mm-hmm. But actually all of the gross things also have a subtle element. But sometimes just the mind, you know, to like to read poetry, nice poetry or something, maybe read Shakespeare, or just to be honored, you know, some chance your name, you know. There's nothing gross happening, you're hearing it, basically, but basically it's in the mind. The mind is also one of the senses, essentially, like the sixth sense. So there's a huge realm of that, you know. And sometimes, you know, you find people conquer the external, like these yogis. You know, they're not going for gross sense gratification. But they, you know, any little slight, and they go off the handle. You know, like a nice story. We'll end with this. Every 12 years or so, there's a big Kumbh Mela, you know, in Prayag, right? Near Allahabad. Because everybody wants mukti. You know. They travel all over, you know, at great expense and difficulty. The whole city grows up. 20 million people all of a sudden, you know, increase. And then, so the government has to create roads, they have the army, you know, I'm sure they have a judicial system, first aid everywhere, hospital. A city grows up. And, it's a nice analogy, I just remember from a lecture. So, there's different groups of babas, babaji, yogis, who come down from the Himalayas to take bath at a certain auspicious moment in the confluence of the, it's called Triveni, because you got the Yamuna there, very holy river, and the Ganges meeting at Prayag, and also this subtle river that we don't see anymore, the Saraswati. So it's three rivers. And at a certain time, astrologically, it's always in January, so it's freezing cold, you take a bath, you get liberation. So people know this, so they come by the millions to take bath. But obviously, a million people can't jump in a river at one time, you know, so there's a hierarchy of who can actually get in there. So the different babas come down. These are all yogis, and Prabhupada told us. They look like they're 50, but they're hundreds of years old. They slow down the breathing, they perform all kinds of things, you know. So these are real yogis, you know. But they're all kind of factions. So which faction is going to get to bathe first? So they have pitched battles sometimes, you know, and the police have to stop them. You know, I don't know if they're using city, you know, throwing mantras or whatever, but there's violence that takes place. Who's going to bathe in it? You know, it's not just the mukti, it's also the honor, it's also the prestige that we get to do first. So why the devotees go there? Prabhupada himself went to one of these. Why? For mukti? No. They know that just by chanting Hare Krishna they get mukti. But in order to give people, because there's so many people come, they don't know anything, you know, prasadam distribution, you know, and they do harinam, they do little, one time they did, I think, a little Rath Yatra, very popular, you know. So it's a preaching opportunity for devotees. I don't even know if they go, I don't think they go in and bathe, you know. It's, but if you get sick and die, you know, or get a serious disease, you're preaching. So, you asked about the cities?
Oh, no, just the difference between gross and subtle.
The gross and subtle, yeah. So one thing that Prabhupada mentioned, so the point is that subtle gratification of bathing first and being honored, this, you know, all these yogis, they still haven't got rid of that. So they're kamis. You know, that's bhukti kami, really. Subtle. So one other note on this, this is a great analogy, you can remember this. So, Prabhupada describes, I think he's quoting maybe Bhaktisiddhanta, how this Kumbh Mela is like a big fair. You know, we have our fairs. And there's so much, you know, it's set up there, right? It's all set up for this temporary city. And like he pointed out, there were roads and there was a judicial system and all kinds of stuff. There has to be a system for feeding so many people. You know, you can imagine. And then after, 2 weeks or something, you know, people start leaving, they've gone out, they bring it down and it disappears. It's just the old big field or whatever it was. Fields, I don't know. Whatever. So probably this material world is like that. It's a big fair that Krishna arranges. and the important point is it has a purpose. The purpose for people of the fair is to get liberation, to bathe in the river. So what's the purpose of this fair? You know? Now, just as in Kumbh Mela, the main business is to get liberation and bathe in the river. But so much other stuff goes on, right? People have their own thing that they're trying to promote. You can imagine, you know, the CDs. Now they probably have every Babaji has his own CD. There's some interesting pictures. I think it was in National Geographic. There's the Baba, you know, with traditional dress, the dreadlocks, the, you know, loincloth and everything. He's got a cell phone. Anyway, so similarly, this world has a purpose, and the purpose is to give us a chance to get out of it by, you know, becoming detached and becoming pure devotees. But there's so much other stuff that goes on that can distract you from the real purpose. But still, at a certain point, it's dismantled. There's a periodic destruction, and there's a complete destruction. So there's no point in getting attached to the things of this world, because ultimately we'll be destroyed, you know, and ultimately the whole thing will be destroyed, and we'll have to start a new term. And if we don't do it by the end of the era, then, you know, millions and millions of years in the body of Mahavishnu. So we should take the gift. This is a fair. This is an arrangement, perfect arrangement for us to go back to Godhead. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.